Morning. My name's Becca, for those of you who've not met me before, and I work at Maybridge Community Church. And this morning, I'm going to look at a question in particular. We're looking at a series of questions at the moment. We've called this sermon series Searchlight, and we're looking at some of the questions that people ask about God, because there's lots of questions. And, you know, we know that in a room this big, there's people who've known God for years and who feel like they've really, you know, you never quite get to the bottom of who he is, but you've got a really good handle on who God is and what it means to know him. And there's people at the other end of the spectrum who are going, I've never really thought about God before. Or maybe I have, but I'm not really sure and I'm not convinced. And the truth is that wherever you are on the spectrum, we always still have questions about who God is. And today, I want to look at one in particular, which, you know, I think that if there was a survey done and they said, if you could ask God one question, what would it be? And this was the question that most people asked. So I'm really glad I got it. Excellent. I will try and do it justice. It's a difficult question. Why does God let people suffer? Why is there pain in the world? Why do bad things happen? Why is there evil? If God's good, what is he doing allowing all the stuff that has been in the headlines of the news over the last few weeks, months, and years? What is going on? You see, it's a problem as old as time. And the thing that I find great comfort from as a Christian is that the Bible doesn't shy away from this. You see, the Bible is full of stories of people in pain, which in itself does not seem very encouraging. But it means that it tackles it. It takes it head on. It means that we hear stories of people, you know, whole nations marched off into slavery. We hear stories of women who've been terribly maltreated. We've got kings being terribly ruthless. And in the midst of it all, some of Israel's, God's people's finest poets writing out these songs and these poems which begin, how long, God, must we suffer? How long? But the encouragement comes from discovering that some of these characters and some of these poets, actually, they begin, how long, God, must we suffer? But they somehow finish by saying, and yet, God, you are amazing. Like, how do you go from one place to the other? How is that possible? What's going on? How do we make sense of all of this? And so I'm going to try and look at some of the parts of the problem that this question gives us, and hopefully come up with an answer that's vaguely satisfactory. But I need to warn you from the beginning, right? I don't have the whole answer. I was talking at breakfast church this morning, and at breakfast church we interact a lot more. And you know, and I just asked them, what's the one question you'd ask God? And between them, they came up with loads. And actually, one of them said, the opposite of this, why does God give us such beautiful things? And I thought, that's an interesting take. That's looking at the world a totally different way around. But the truth is, I have a list of questions that I am storing up somewhere in my head for the day that I meet God in person in heaven, which I'm going to, if heaven's as good as it's cracked out to be, I will get time with Jesus on my own going, right, and another thing. What about this? What about that? Well, I mean, I suspect that when I get there, I'll take one look at Jesus and go, oh, yeah, none of that really matters. But we'll, you know, we'll see. In the meanwhile, I've got some, you know, confidence and going, I can ask God that one day. It's okay. But for now, let's have a think about this. But I want to begin by really having a think about the fact that actually we look at the word suffering and we think about pain and we think about hurt and we always assume that it's bad. And actually, it isn't always. Sometimes pain is a good thing. Not in a terribly weird and quirky way. We're not going to go there. But it's a good thing. It's something that we need. It alerts us to danger. So, for example, on a very, very simple level, you know, if you put your finger near a flame, or any part of you for that matter, it will get hot and hurt. So I had a very real example of this on my youngest daughter, Meggie's first birthday, when I'd made her a beautiful cake with one candle on it, and we dimmed the lights, and we sang happy birthday, and her little fingers just reached out to touch the shiny thing in the middle of the cake, because I hadn't really thought that bit through. And she reached out, and I shouted no, and she ignored me because she was only one. And she put her hands out, and she quickly pulled them back because of the pain of the flame. But she pulled it back so quickly, it meant that she didn't actually get burnt. She did cry, because it did hurt, but it didn't last. It ended. Sometimes pain is a good thing. Pain can warn us of all kinds of things. You know, actually, if we didn't ever get tummy aches, that's quite mummy talk, isn't it, tummy aches? But you know what I mean. If we didn't get stomach aches, then actually we wouldn't always know what they're pointing us towards. You know, if our appendixes were capable of rupturing and being infected without causing us pain, that would be a disaster. Because there are several people in this room who wouldn't be alive because they wouldn't have known that they needed to get themselves seen to. The pain is horrible, but it enables you, like an early warning system, to know that you need to go and get treatment. My youngest daughter, again, she's just going to be my example for the day. She started to have all kinds of problems, and actually that alerted us to the fact that she had celiac disease. Now, I don't need to tell you what that is, but if she'd have continued on with that, she eventually would have died. It mattered that we found out what was the matter. The pain enabled her to get healed, to get better. And sometimes the treatment is horrible. Somebody at breakfast church was talking about, gosh, well, I can remember when I had to go through chemo for my breast cancer. And it was horrible and it was awful. And some days I wish I didn't have to survive. But I survived through it, and the pain of the chemo got me through. Sometimes pain is good. And sometimes some of the things that we see in the world, like volcanoes and earthquakes, they seem terrible. I would not have wanted to have been on that island in New Zealand, you know, back before Christmas when that volcano went off. That was horrible. But actually they restore nutrients into the biosphere. You know, some of these things matter. Even floods, they're terrible, they cause devastation, but they help to, you know, distribute nutrients around the floodplains all around them, and you get this beautiful lush ground where everything grows really well. It's not all bad, and it's not all God either, if we stop and if we think about it. The truth is, when we look at the world all around us and we see some of these things, violence, discrimination, greed and abuse, so much of what we see as we look around the world is caused by human beings making terrible decisions or even just making mistakes. But it still hurts. That plane might have been shot down by accident, but that doesn't make it feel any better, does it? If it's your family who was on that plane, it doesn't make it okay that it was an accident. It still hurts. It's still pain. It's still suffering. And in all that I say this morning, I want to acknowledge that. You see, it's really easy to trot out some answers, and it can sound quite glib. But I know that in a room this big, there are people who are suffering, or who have suffered, or who are about to. There are people who have lost people they love. There are people struggling with illnesses they just can't shake off. People who desperately wish they could get pregnant and they just don't seem to be able to, or desperately wish they could find a partner and they can't. People who have lost their job, people who have lost their money, people who are frightened they're about to lose their home. People who've had things happen they've never told anybody because it's too shameful and it's too awful and they don't know how to talk about it, and they live with the legacy of what happened in their childhood or at school or with that person. We carry it in us, and it's real, and it's more than some explanations can ever quite write off. But please, in all that I say, know that I understand that, and I'm not trying to belittle it at any point. But we do need to acknowledge that sometimes we make things a lot worse. I, in 2013, went to visit Haiti 3 years after they'd had this enormous earthquake. And you know, the earthquake was a magnitude 7 on the Richter scale. And it absolutely, in a number of seconds, brought the whole country and the capital city in particular to its knees, literally. The estimates of how many people died are somewhere between 100,000 and 250,000. But frankly, it doesn't matter where you sit on that scale and you plump as the final number. It's terrible how many people died. 250,000 people lost their homes, even though they didn't lose their lives. The country is still recovering from the devastation. It's awful. And sometimes we call these things, don't we, acts of God. But it's important sometimes to put it into context. You see, years before in Los Angeles, there was another earthquake of a way higher scale. It was magnitude 8, which is exponentially bigger than 7, actually. The scale's weird. Look it up sometime. But only 57 people died in Los Angeles. And similar one in Peru, and again, just, you know, a couple of hundred people died. Now, it's not good if you're related to those people, but the difference is extraordinary. And the difference actually is poverty, and it's power, and it's corruption. And if Martin McCabe was here, I'm not sure if he is, he'd be saying, and it's building regulations, and whether or not you enforce them, and whether or not you build your bricks well, and whether or not you use those bricks and build your buildings well, and whether or not you enforce the rules, and whether or not you can bribe the officials to overlook the fact that you didn't. and whether or not anybody actually cares about the people in that country and whether or not they're taken care of. You see, the decisions that we make and those, you know, the power and the greed, they begin to get into everything. And they make everything worse. As you look around the world and you come across figures like this, which sound so horrific, which are so horrific, 6.2 million children die every year from preventable diseases. I'm not talking about things that nobody knows how to fix yet. I'm talking about little things like diarrhea, little things that you can get vaccinations against, things that children shouldn't die of. Half those children die before they reach a month old. It's horrific. And it's totally preventable. But the world and the powers that be have not decided to prioritize keeping those children alive. The money's there, the resources are there, the knowledge is there, but mankind has decided that those children don't matter because most of those children live in sub-Saharan Africa. And around the world, the acts of mankind have huge effects. It's estimated that in the first 15 years of this century, 5.6 million children died because of tax evasion. That's hard to understand that. And yet it's true. Because big corporations go and set up mines in Zambia, for example, but they don't really want to pay the Zambian rate of tax because it's astronomic. They actually set up, you know, they set themselves up and make it look like they're operating at the Cayman Islands or Switzerland, so they don't have to pay tax in Zambia. But that means that Zambia now can't afford schooling, hospitals, vaccinations for their children. Because someone, somewhere, needs to turn over a bigger buck than they would if they paid their dues in the country they were in. I could go on and on, and frankly, if you give me half a chance, I would, about this kind of a thing, because so much of the suffering that we see in the world is brought on by the decisions of mankind. But it doesn't take away this question. Why doesn't God stop it? Why doesn't he just come down and blast them all out of the atmosphere? Why doesn't he come down? Why did he let Hitler live? Like, why did he let Hitler be born? You know, why doesn't he just render some people mentally incapable so that they can't be given positions of power? It's possible that that's happened and they've still got positions of power, but we won't go there. Say nothing else. Like, but why doesn't it stop? You know, you realise quickly that actually it would turn everything into nonsense. You know, if I held up a gun to shoot Phil, he wouldn't even know actually because he can't see, but that would be really cheeky. But imagine if I did and God went, now I'm going to turn it into a banana. And you go, well, that's nonsense. And that's a nonsense world where God just steps in and stops everything nasty that's going to happen. But the truth is, this is what sits at the heart of some people's problem with God, or even the very idea of a God. It's what sits at the heart. And what I want to do for a minute is to kind of like take a pause and to step aside and to tell you some basic things that Christians believe, because from here we can build on it and we can get to somewhere else. So here are some basic things that Christians believe, which the first one, hopefully everybody would agree with, okay? The first one is that God exists. If you don't think God exists, you are not a Christian. That's just straightforward. And that's fine, you're allowed to make up your own mind. But fundamentally, we believe that there is a God. And then we believe that that God is omnipotent, big word, means he's all powerful. He can do anything. Nothing is impossible for him. We sing songs about it. In fact, we've sung songs about God being all-powerful, haven't we, already? Number three, God is omniscient, another big fat word, which basically means that he knows everything. So if something bad happens, if my sister-in-law loses her baby, that didn't happen because God missed something. He wasn't asleep for that. He didn't have his eyes closed. He didn't miss it. It happened even though he knew, even though he's all powerful. You begin to see where people's problem comes from, don't you? God is completely good. Okay, how do we tie all these things together? And then finally, we believe that evil exists as well. We believe God's more powerful, but that evil exists. And this sits at the problem of a lot of people's problem with God. So David Hume was a philosopher back in the 18th century, and he put it like this. And in truth, there have been a lot of people say the same thing in a different way a lot of times since, but this sums it up quite nicely. Is God willing to prevent evil, but not able? Well, then he's impotent, he's powerless. And is he able to, but not willing? Well, then he's malevolent, or he's not very nice. Is he both able and willing? Well, then why is there evil? And so the truth is, he sums up this whole dilemma that faces all of us if we stop to think. but which atheists have really picked up on and gone, well, here's your main proof. Someone like Stephen Fry would say, this is why I don't believe in God. Because if he's good and if he's all powerful, why then do children die? Why then do terrible things happen? Why then? Like, those three things are, they can't all exist in the same world, is what they're saying. Which, at first level, perhaps seems plausible. But it's not quite as straightforward as that. And I want to take another slight sidetrack, so bear with me. You see, because in that phrase, there is an assumption that suffering or pain is tied up somehow with evil. And I think that anybody in the room, if I started talking again about Hitler or some of the other evil despots that we've seen around the world, or some of the, you know, stories that we've seen in the news of, you know, people who've been arrested and put away, or, you know, I saw a story over the Christmas holidays of a guy who's gone down as the most prolific rapist in UK history. And I think that there's not a person in the room who would struggle with the concept of calling, of saying that behaviour, that's evil, that's evil happening right in front of us. But you have to think about this question. How do we know it's evil? Like, what? Now, at Breakfast Church, I could sit down and we had this discussion. But how do we know it's evil? What? How do we decide what evil looks like? How do we decide that we can classify something as bad? How do we decide that something is good, for that matter? Where does that kind of shifting sands, now from culture to culture, things shift slightly, don't they? But fundamentally, across the world, we have some things that we think are bad and things that are good. And even people like David Hume will say, well, if evil exists, God can't. You go, well, hang on. Where did your concept of evil come from? You see, people who don't believe in God and who think that the whole world exists out of a matter of chance. Just somewhere once upon a time, there was a big bang that came out of nowhere. And out of that, through a chance process of, you know, endless chances of, you know, process of endless chances, we had a world which developed some forms of life. And those forms of life developed through evolution. And not all of this stands completely against the Bible, but fundamentally this, bear with me because I'm getting there. I am, slowly. All these chances, all these things, you know, life forms, and then it evolves, and eventually we end up with mankind, and the whole of that process is natural selection, the survival of the fittest. Well, if you do that, then your morality is based on what is best for me. What is best for me? What will enable me to survive? What will enable me and my bloodline to survive, and to survive well and strong and fit? We see, if you follow that line of thought, natural selection, survival of the fittest, then that's what your morality is based on. At which point, Hitler marching off anybody with any kind of deformity or disability or weakness, well, actually, that's quite good, because that's natural selection. That's survival of the fittest. That's ensuring the purity of the human race. If you follow that line of thought, then actually setting up a coal mine in Zambia, exploiting the local workers and never paying any taxes to the local government, that's just clever. Survival of the fittest, natural selection, exploiting the weak, not caring if they die. If evolutionary morality carries on, firemen will never run into a burning building. Because why would you put yourself at risk for someone who frankly didn't have the brains to get out themselves? And if you're a policeman, you'd never put yourself in harm's way, because then you might not survive. It means that a story that I saw on the news last week of some teenage lads who stopped to help a mum and her baby who'd fallen in a canal and helped to get her out, they wouldn't do that. That's not survival of the fittest. That's something else entirely. The truth is that if we have this, you know, concept of good and evil that transcends what is best for us as an individual, it does not come from evolutionary theory. It does not come through natural selection. It has to come from somewhere else. And it points, this concept of good and bad. It comes, this concept of evil, and it points towards something different, something better, something higher, something supernatural that perhaps has instilled its sense of morality into us. A sense of morality where we applaud people who sacrifice and put them others people first, who enables us to sit there and think, actually the best thing is to help other people out, even when it causes you pain. And we give awards to people who are brave and courageous and who go against all their natural instincts for other people. It's extraordinary. And the Bible puts it like this. A guy called Paul wrote to a church in a place called Philippi, and he says a whole load of things. Not Philippi, Rome, I'm reading the wrong bit. And he says this in the midst of it all, which is very helpful. He says, they demonstrate that God's law is written in their hearts, for their own conscience and thoughts either accuse them or tell them that they are doing right. And he's talking about actually that little voice in the back of your head that cartoons paint as an angel and a devil, you know, whether you believe in that or not. You know, of that little voice that goes, that was a good thing. Don't do that again. Well, definitely don't do that in the first place. He's saying, you know, that conscience that's inside us, that's God's law written in our hearts. He said, this is about more than, you know, evolutionary theory. This is about saying, when you were made, when you were formed in your mother's womb, you were imprinted in your DNA as this sense of what is right and what is wrong, because you were made in the image of God. And you were made to know and to understand like him what you should and what you shouldn't do. It's there, it's intrinsic, it's part of you. And this concept of evil in the first place and suffering and pain actually points back to something bigger and something higher. It doesn't answer the whole question, but it does mean that we can't discount God. It means we can't knock him out of where we are. But it does mean we can come back to this question, which I've sidetracked around quite a long time. Why doesn't God stop it still? Well, it's complicated. If we go back to what an atheist might say, here's another one, J.R. Mackey, a good thing, in other words, God, always eliminates evil as far as it can, and there are no limits to what an omnipotent, all-powerful thing can do. Except that that's not quite true, is it, when you stop and you think about it? The thing is, just because you, in fact, C.S. Lewis said this, just because you put the words God can in front of a sentence doesn't make it right. So God can't do things that are mutually exclusive, things that are two opposites. So one of the things that sometimes people go is, God, can God make a mountain that he can't move? No, because that's a nonsense. It's a nonsense. And just because you put the words God can at the front of the sentence doesn't stop it being nonsense. It's still nonsense. And so God, in his goodness, cannot do things that are contradictory, which leads us to another question, actually. What if, in order to eliminate evil, God had to sacrifice a greater good? Please bear with me if I'm messing with your heads here. Just hold on in. It's all coming round. What if? You see, when Karen at Breakfast Church said, if I hadn't have had my chemo, I wouldn't have survived. Like, it wasn't worth her sacrificing, eliminating the evil of the chemo, because actually the greater good was survival at the end. Any mother who has been through childbirth will tell you, well, most, it was worth the pain. Like, they'd do it again to have their child again. I would tell you, those of you who've known me much at all know that I had a very difficult, in fact, abusive first marriage. And I wouldn't go back and change a thing, because without it, I wouldn't have my two children. We know sometimes there are things we wouldn't sacrifice because what came out the other end was totally worth it. It was a greater good. And this goes to a cosmic scale when we think about the world. You see, the Bible tells us that in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth and the sea and everything that's in it. And when he finished, he stopped and he looked at it and it was very good. He made a good and perfect world. He'd made human beings to live within it, made in his image to take care of this earth and to steward it, is the word that we often use, but to rule over it, to take care of it, to protect it. He'd created this beautiful, perfect world. And then in his goodness, he chose to make men and women in his image, and he chose to give them this phrase that we call free will. He chose to say, do you know what? I've given you great knowledge, but I'm going to let you choose whether or not you love me. I'm going to let you choose whether or not you follow me. I'm going to let you choose whether or not you obey me. And it's this astonishing choice that he gives people, but that he gives because he's good, because he doesn't want to be an evil dictator who manipulates his people and tells them what they have to do. He doesn't want to be a puppeteer just marching his toys along and, you know, dancing them to his tune. He wants to create a people who have real choice, who are able to exercise real love because it's a choice, who are able to do great good because it's a choice, who are able to demonstrate great courage because it's a choice. In his goodness, he gives us free will. But off the back of that, we get this broken world as humankind chooses not to love him, chooses not to follow him, and chooses fundamentally not to obey him. And the story is caught up in the story of Adam and Eve as Eve eats an apple. But it means that we end up with a world that is broken. The Bible tells us that incident separated humankind from God, but it also somehow broke the relationship between God and the world. And actually, what we see now is a world that is slowly decaying, slowly falling apart at the seams. Second law of thermodynamics, for any physicists amongst us, he'll probably correct me at the end because I'll get it slightly wrong, is fundamentally this, that anything left to itself slowly falls apart and decays without outside intervention. That things don't just create, they just naturally decay. They just naturally fall apart. And so we live in a world that has earthquakes, and we live in a world that has terrible storms, and we live in a world of sickness and disease and the rest of it. And it's this broken, messed up world. But fundamentally, God decided that it was better than the alternative. John Stackhouse says it like this. He says, God preferred on the whole the global result of the drama of sin and salvation to a world without it. And it doesn't answer all the questions of why me, or why my husband, or why my dad, or why my child, or any of those things. But it begins to put it into a bit of a different light. God said, this is better than no world, no people, nothing. I had to give them choice because the alternative was a bunch of robots. And they made a bad choice, and I always knew they would. But it was better than the alternative. I'm not going to sacrifice one thing and lose a greater good. It's just not worth it. And fundamentally, the Bible promises us that in the end, a day will come when God will restore the earth. He will bring it back into all that it should ever have been. And he says that in that day, there will be no more, that he will wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, because the old order, the messed up, broken order of things has passed away. And so there's hope. But the reason there's hope is because somewhere between the beginning and the end, God got stuck right in. God was with us right in the middle of everything. God didn't leave us on our own. God didn't leave us to get on with it. He isn't, you know, the God who says, well, actually, it's all about karma, and you'll just come back in another life. And if you're suffering, it's because you did something bad before. And he isn't the God who says, do you know what? It's not even true. It's all in your mind. If you get to a higher enlightened state of being, you'll realize that this pain and suffering is nothing. He's a God who came and sat in the middle of it all and understood the mess and experienced the pain, and he sat with it. I want to play a short video of a story. People don't even really know who wrote it, but it just begins to explain and help us to understand actually where God fits in this messy old world that we live in.
At the end of time, billions of people were seated on a great plain before God's throne. Most shrank back from the brilliant light before them, but some groups near the front talked heatedly, not cringing with cringing shame, but with belligerence.
Can God judge us? How can he know about suffering?
Snapped a pert young brunette. She ripped open a sleeve to reveal a tattooed number from a Nazi concentration camp.
We endured terror, beatings, torture, death.
In another group, a black man lowered his collar.
What about this?
He demanded, showing an ugly rope burn.
Lynched for no crime except being black.
In another crowd, there was a pregnant schoolgirl with sullen eyes.
Why should I suffer?
She murmured.
It wasn't my fault.
Far out across the plain were hundreds of such groups. Each had a complaint against God for the evil and suffering he had permitted in his world. How lucky God was to live in heaven, where all was sweetness and light, where there was no weeping or fear, no hunger or hatred. What did God know of all that man had been forced to endure in this world? for God leads a pretty sheltered life, they said. So each of these groups sent forth their leader, chosen because he had suffered the most. A Jew, a black man, a person from Hiroshima, a horribly deformed arthritic, an abused child. In the center of the vast plain, they consulted with each other. At last, they were ready to present their case. It was rather clever. Before God could be qualified to be their judge, he must endure what they had endured. Their decision was that God should be sentenced to live on earth as a man. Let him be born a Jew. Let the legitimacy of his birth be doubted. Give him a work so difficult that even his family will think him out of his mind. Let him be betrayed by his closest friends. Let him face false charges, be tried by a prejudiced jury, and convicted by a cowardly judge. Let him be tortured. At the last, let him see what it means to be terribly alone. Then let him die. So there can be no doubt he died, let there be a great host of witnesses to verify it. As each leader announced his portion of the sentence, loud murmurs of approval went up from the throng of people assembled. When the last had finished pronouncing sentence, there was a long silence. No one uttered a word. No one moved. For suddenly, all knew that God had already served his sentence.
Makes you think, doesn't it? The Bible puts it like this, very succinctly. Though he was God, and this is Paul writing to a church in Philippi this time. He's talking about Jesus. And he says, though Jesus was God, he didn't think of equality with God as something to cling to. Instead, he gave up his divine privileges. He took the humble position of a slave. And he was born as a human being. When he appeared in human form, he humbled himself in obedience to God and died a criminal's death on the cross. It's extraordinary that the God of heaven, this almighty creator, all-knowing, all-powerful, all-good, should choose to come and sit in the mess with the rest of us. You see, the beautiful, even though it's desperately ugly, thing about the cross is this. In that moment, Jesus took the greatest act of evil, killing the Creator, and he turned it into the greatest good. He turned the world on its head. In his suffering and in his pain, he turned the world upside down, and it's extraordinary. And he did it so that he could save mankind, so that there could be hope for a different future. He did it so that we would know that he understands, but it was more than that. He did it to rescue us. And the most astonishing thing about Jesus is that he overcame the suffering. He rose again. He came back to life. And he came back and walked the earth again for a few weeks. But at the end of those weeks, when he left his friends, he made a promise. He promised that he wouldn't leave them altogether. They wouldn't see him walking around like they had done over the last few years anymore. But he would send his spirit to live with them and in them, and with and in anybody who chooses to follow him. And that's the astonishing thing, because that means we carry God in us. He is with us. We are never alone. Wherever we go, whatever happens, however awful and terrible and, you know, impossible it seems to push through, God is always with us. And through his spirit, as Christians, we are able to access the kind of peace that only God can give. We're able to access the kind of strength and courage and resilience that only God can give. We're able to know that we're not alone. We have this God who loves us desperately, who is with us. You see, this God is phenomenal. And there's one little story that we find in the Bible when it tells us about who Jesus was and the time that he spent on earth that I just want us to finish with. You see, his friend died. He had a friend called Lazarus, and his friend died. And Lazarus's sisters were devastated. And Jesus came and met them. And his response to them was not, oh, we'll have a look at the bigger picture. Don't worry about it. And his response wasn't, oh, there's more important things on earth. And his response wasn't, count your blessings and think of all the good things I have given you. And it wasn't, well, let's just celebrate the time that we had. Jesus' response to his friend's grief was that he wept. That's the God that we follow. That's the God that you can come to, whatever your suffering looks like. That's the God you can come to and to know that he hasn't got a whole list of platitudes for you to tell you that the life's going to be better. But he will stand with you and he will weep with you and he will give you his peace and he will give you his strength and he will help you make it out the other side. But it helps to know that he wept. It helps to know that he understands. It helps to know that he's overcome. And it helps to know that one day, there will be a day when there will be no more tears and there will be no more mourning and a new day will come. And we're not there yet. We live in the mess, but we live in the mess together. That's what God's church is for, to stand together, to support each other, to love each other, to cry with each other sometimes, to not have to have all the answers because we don't, and I don't. But actually to know that we battle this thing through together with God with us all the time through his Spirit. So I'm going to invite the band to come up and we're going to sing. But very importantly, I'm going to ask the prayer team as well to come and stand. And there'll be some people at the front here and there'll be some prayer team at the back. Or you might just like to pray with the person sat next to you, or you might just like to sit and pray where you are. That is fine. But I know that often we find our way through suffering by doing it together and by accessing that God who loves us so much. And we do that through prayer, whether it's on our own or together, but it's good to do it together. So if there's anything you'd like prayer for, whether that's a particular pain that you're carrying at the moment, or whether it's something else entirely, then do come for prayer. And let's just allow this last time of worship that we have to help us to look at this awesome God that we have, at his faithfulness, at his goodness, at his power, to know that actually sometimes God does stop it. It's always good to ask God to step in and do a miracle. I know that he does. I've seen it happen. But then to be able to understand that sometimes he doesn't, and that we still find God in that place too. So let me pray, and then I'll hand over. When we think, Jesus, about all that you gave up, Prince of Heaven, King of Kings, Creator of the world, that you should come and live in a mess with us, be born to nobodies, have to live as a refugee, to be misunderstood, to be maltreated, to be beaten. It's beyond comprehension that you would give up all that you had for that. Help us to understand that you did that for us. Help us to understand what that means. Help us to get our heads around how we live in this world, holding the tension of the things that are hard and painful and difficult and challenging with you, a God of love, a God who is good, a God whose name we need to lift up and praise. Help us to work that out and find our way through, but help us to find you fundamentally. Fill us again with your Holy Spirit so that we have your eyes to see. We have your peace and your power and your passion living inside us, helping us to be your messengers to other people, to come alongside others in their suffering. But for now, Lord, help us to focus in on you, you with us in everything. Amen.